You're very welcome to another episode of the Sideshow Garden Podcast. For anything you hear on today's episode, at Sideshow on Twitter, facebook.com/thesideshow and sideshow.com. This is a part one of two with garden writer Tim Richardson. And there is an entire plethora of accolades to come after his name further too, but I'll leave it at garden writer just for now. Part two will air not next week, but the week after. So if you subscribe in iTunes or Spotify or one of them, it'll drop straight into your phone. Let's get on with part one and enjoy.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I've got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
Hello.
Tim.
Hi, Peter.
Good, good, good. Okay. Just tell me some random information about your favourite football team or the last piece of something you bought. I'll just check sound.
Yeah, fine. Well, I'm just shaping up at the moment to buy possibly a tweed suit, which I've had my eye on from a shop in Covent Garden, which I find this time of year is a difficult time of year in terms of clothing. It's problematic because it's, you know, you want a lightweight, but still quite potentially warm item. Possibly a light tweed, Donegal tweed, perhaps could serve.
I'm warm with you. Right, let me see. Check at this end. I've got somebody leaving a message on another line. Tim, we'll ignore that. Let me see. Okay, we'll try this and we'll go from...
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Sideshow Garden Podcast.
It's unusual to be talking to you not from a car park, listeners of the Sideshow. You might be aware of recent we had Joe Thompson. We sat on a Ifor Williams trailer in Battersea Park in London. It's not, I'm aware, what she and others may be accustomed to, but nonetheless, you do know that I try hard to bring you the best of the best, and this week's episode is a little bit of a gem. Personal fan, and my guest this week is Tim Richardson. Tim, you're very welcome to the Sideshow. How are you, my good man?
Fine, thanks, Peter. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. I've got so many things that I want to talk to you about, mainly because the little people are running doolally in my head around the place, and I am slightly unsure of where to start, but I suppose by way of introduction, maybe you should do that for yourself, and then I'll try and get into the good bits if I can.
Okay, so I'm a landscape and garden writer. I'm a historian, and I call myself a critic of gardens and landscape, and I've been doing this, well, pretty much all my career for about 25 years so far. And as a journalist, I write mainly for the Daily Telegraph, but also for people like Gardens Illustrated and Country Life and so on. And my focus, I suppose, is really on the books I produce, either on garden history subjects, like one I wrote about the 18th century landscape garden called Arcadian Friends, or one on the 20th century English garden, or on more contemporary things. I wrote a book called The New English Garden a few years ago, which is all about naturalistic planting design. Well, not all about, but a lot of it is. And also write about landscape architecture and city planning in books like Avant Gardeners and Futurescapes. I also run the Chelsea Fringe Festival, which is the alternative garden festival at the time of the Chelsea Flower Show. And I advised the National Trust on gardens, and as a historian, wrote the course on landscape history for Oxford University you can do online.
Your latest book, I should add, is You Should Have Been Here Last Week. Correct me if I'm wrong. It turns out that you were involved in comedy at Oxford University. Was it with the Seven Raymonds?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I did a lot of comedy. And initially, when I left university, I did do a bit of comedy. I did a Radio 4 show, actually, and I was an actor. But that I gave up after about 10 months, 8 or 10 months or something. I remember I was auditioning to be a pirate in Birmingham Rep's production of Peter Pan, and I was having to sort of dance and sing in somewhere called the Pineapple Dance Studios in Covent Garden. And I was sort of dancing and prancing around, and I was thinking, I don't want to do this. Why am I here? What am I doing? And I realized that my friends who are actors you know, we really wanted to do that. We're desperate to get an advert or something, and we're quite happy to do the terrible jobs we were doing at the time in warehouses and all the rest of it. And so I'd sort of begun writing at that time, and I found that oddly quite a performative experience as well. So I gave that up. But oddly enough, I have been performing again in a way a little bit. I was just doing it last week, actually, a little bit, because about 4 years ago, I started writing poetry quite seriously, and had a collection published as a result of a competition which was run. And so as a result, I do readings of my work, and some of the poems I write are what I call dramatic monologues. So they're kind of in character. So I sort of find myself performing, and of course giving talks and lectures, which I do regularly, is also a sort of form of performing. So I'm kind of still doing it a bit.
What struck me, and I'm a huge comedy buff, mainly of the black and whites, the Marx Brothers, going all the way back, but the most famous, I should say, outside of yourself, of course, Tim, to make it out of the Seven Raymonds, was a gentleman by the name of Stuart Lee. And there is a song that you performed, which has, well, it's on YouTube, called Talking Crap Again. And it does have a segue in, believe me, you listen at home, to your latest book. And I'm going to... Yeah, I'm well prepared here.
Well, Stu, he's still a dear friend, you know, he's still a great mate of mine. And we still talk a lot, you know, about comedy matters. And in fact, because of this, he actually gave me a credit on his last, one of his last stand-up series. Because, you know, we sort of talk around things. And I think sometimes some of his riffs and themes come out of that. So that was quite good fun that he did that for me.
Bear with me here, folks. I don't know whether I should put page turning sound effects into this one, but I just want to start on page 4 for those of you listening at home, and I'm going to take this. Number 1, Sissinghurst, July, August 2004. I went to Sissinghurst, Kent recently and was appalled. It wasn't that it was badly gardened. It wasn't. It wasn't because my National Trust carrot cake had a toenail in it. It didn't. It was just that it felt like a con. I'll scroll forward and I'll go to page 7, and it says, it is surely only a matter of time before Homebase starts selling Black Polonex and Galois cigarettes as everyday gardening accoutrements. I hope I pronounced that correctly in my Irish accent. And finally, to small gardens. The basic problem is that small gardens almost always look dreadful. My garden looks dreadful. My neighbour's garden looks dreadful. All the small gardens shown on television look dreadful, as do nearly all of those illustrated in books. Most of the small gardens designed by gardeners look dreadful. And I just thought in my head, hold on a second. And what actually happened when the review copy came in, and I will be very honest for those of you listening at home, when I'm sent a gardening book, for example, Charles Dow, not to suggest that I know absolutely everything in the planet, but when Charles says, this is how we do this, as the opening paragraph, I have a rough idea horticulturally what's about to come. This is the first book that's come into me, I would suggest, in almost 400 episodes that I read flat in one day, number one. And two, it wasn't what I was expecting when your publisher got in touch with me. Does that surmise correctly on your behalf, Peter Donegan's review of your book?
Well, I'm really delighted, Peter. That's fantastic. I'm so pleased. I suppose, the thing to know about the book is it's a collection of journalism, of articles I've written over the last, I think, as you said, the first one was 2004, and they go up to sort of last year or something. So there's lots of little gobbets. So I guess I'm really delighted that you wanted to read it all in one day. And a couple of people have said a similar thing to me. But it's also, I guess, I was imagining it was the sort of book that might end up in the smallest room in the house, you know what I mean? Because you can read it in quite small amounts. But I don't know. I think I try to write in a different, with a slightly different attitude. I try to write humorously. You know, there isn't enough humor, I think, in gardens somehow. And also with a sort of sense of critical detachment and a historical context. So what I don't do with my writing, and there are no articles, as you have noticed, in this book, I don't write about horticulture. You know, I'm not a fantastic horticulturist. I enjoy gardening, but I don't set myself up as a horticulturist. And if an editor rings me and asks, well, they don't do this anymore, but it has happened, ask me for sort of 800 words on how to grow sweet peas or something, I leave it to my brilliant colleagues who can do that. I just sort of decline, really. So I suppose I've found a little niche for myself, and maybe that's what you enjoyed. It's a little bit different.
It's the most humorous thing I've read since, and I do have a copy of this book on my shelf. H.H. Thomas in 1927 wrote a book, An Easy Guide to Gardening. And on page 16, he notes, commence by digging the ground 2 foot deep. And this is a conversation that I had with Charles Dowding. And I just thought in my head, what is going on? I really did not get what it was all about. However, what I will say to the listeners listening to this and to back this up, Charles and yourself are the only two interviews of books that I have done in the year 2018. And that is for very good reason, because I don't think I can bluff the listeners of The Sod Show into saying that I think this book is genius, when in fact I wouldn't read it myself, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, there aren't very many really good books which come out, and I do a lot of book reviewing, and you know, and I get into terrible trouble really, because again with that I tend to you know, slightly sort of shoot from the hip really, and I expect similar treatment, you know, myself. I mean, I've read quite a lot of books in the papers and the magazines, so yeah, I mean, I take the same sort of view really, because these books are quite expensive, and so you want to let readers know whether it's actually worth having them or not. And I do feel that in all book reviewing, not just garden books, there's a slightly back scratchy you scratch my back, I scratch yours sort of attitude sometimes. And there's an awful lot of very kind reviewing that goes on, which I'm not sure is really that helpful to the reader. And I certainly would expect this sort of treatment myself with the books I produce.
I've probably done you a disservice, Tim, in a sense, because we've been talking for about 10 plus minutes now. And really, well, I've slightly deviated off the point, but I think that's par for the course when it comes to Peter Donegan and his magic brain. Skewing back, however, into what you do best, or one of the things you do very well, but it was your writing of the late, great John Brooks, who, as I noted to you yesterday in conversation, I think I have more of John's books on my shelf than any other garden writer in my 42 years on this planet, and gardening since the age of five. But what you wrote about John, I think it was published in Gardens Illustrated after he had passed. And just to go with the opening paragraph, and you say, after almost half a century at the top of his profession, John Brooks remains an angry young man over coffee and chocolate digestives in the modernist interior of his home in the stable block in Denman's, his Sussex garden that is open to the public. John is attacking the state of garden design in Britain today. It's all a bit dismal, he begins. I know more about what's happening abroad now, because there doesn't seem to be anything interesting going on here. He cites Russia, where he is currently working, as a fruitful new design area, although he does bemoan their penchant for bling, hot tubs with built-in stereos. And it is the first time I have ever read about anybody, be it in the horticultural industry or not, where I actually spat my coffee across my writing whilst reading it. And it was in true Tim style. You didn't blow smoke. You opened with what I didn't expect that you may open with, but then at the same token, it didn't also surprise me.
Well, that's good to know. I mean, especially as just last week, I've had a piece returned to me by a magazine, an interview piece with the suggestion that I'm too negative. And I initially denied this, told them I'm not going to change it. And I have to earn a living, you see, as a journalist. So over the weekend, I was thinking about this and thinking, I can't really take this attitude. So I was sort of, I cooled off a bit and rang them and then made a few changes. But I do, you know, I did it very reluctantly, and I explained to them, you know, I'm only trying to reflect the truth of the matter, and also trying to interest the readers, because I don't believe that readers just want to hear a load of bland praise of people, and they want to sort of get a sense of who the person is. I mean, that article on John Brooks did appear when he was alive, and it was difficult because John, you know, got quite cantankerous in later life, and he was so rude about everyone in the gardens world, even down to naming individual landscape designers and garden designers who are current now, and it was all kind of going on the record potentially, and I didn't quote him saying all of that stuff, but you know, I felt that I couldn't really just sort of gloss over this outburst.
this is a conversation that's come up slightly repeatedly when I speak with Stephanie Mahon of the Society of Garden Designers Journal magazine, when I speak with Andrew Fisher Tomlin, a name that seems to crop up somewhat over and over again, and even of more recent times in conversation with Joe Thompson and speaking about what happened maybe with James Besson's garden. And on one hand, when James did that garden with Helen in Chelsea, there was criticism of it, and I have been the recipient of people who decided to use expletives at gardens and about gardens that I made and designed. And on one hand, I don't know how you musically analogize it, but I'm not a jazz fan, let alone a free jazz fan. However, even if you take it to Irish music, there are things that I would be critical of because they essentially talk about nothing but negativity and put it into song format, which is even worse again. Criticism in horticulture is something that we seem to miss, and it is something that I quite enjoy, so long as, how would you say it, in secondary school, where we were taught to back everything up with quotes. When you spoke about even Romeo and Juliet, you must and you had to do that. But you seem to do that part of it quite well. So I never read your writing as criticism. I just appreciate that you don't like it, but also here's why. And I think on one hand, we maybe need a little bit more of it. And as we spoke about gardening books, Tim, at the start of this conversation, there is also a little bit of, isn't everything wonderful? Didn't I say something nice about your book? When all of us know there's an element of the Emperor's New Clothes about it, and we've seen it published 20,000 times over.
Yeah, well, I think there's a difficulty with this word criticism. So people in general usage, criticism means negative comment about something. You say, I'm criticizing you. But actually, in a literary or journalistic context or an academic context, that's not quite what criticism is. You know, criticism is an appraisal of something. And in fact, it can be extremely positive. So that's sort of where I'm coming from with it. And generally in gardens, and even in my work, we tend not to write about things which we think are no good. We tend not to. And I certainly wouldn't be critical in terms of being very negative about a private garden which I was visiting, which is, say, opening up for the National Garden Scheme. But the sorts of gardens which I think are fair game are gardens which are open to the paying public. Gardens particularly which are run by institutions like the National Trust or English Heritage, or big places like Alnwick Castle and so on, anywhere really where people are making, you know, asking the public to sort of shell out, if you like, to go in, then I think that it's fair game to let them know what it is that they're getting. And I never just reel off a lot of expletives, or anything like that, but I might slightly mock the garden. And I do every year, I do these odds, these sort of like racing odds in the Daily Telegraph about the Chelsea Flower Show gardens. And in those, I really try to make people laugh. I really want that spitting out your coffee moment from my readers. But absolutely, the more people who spit out their coffee, the better from my point of view. So that's absolutely what I'm after. And it can, you know, every year at Chelsea, you know, I have, most of the time they take it really well, actually, the designers, when I make these little comments, and they don't get angry with me. But, you know, I do have moments. A couple of years ago, I was critical of Goldman Sachs' garden, which Chris Beardshaw designed, which was a year when a number of the sponsors at Chelsea were producing gardens which they call community gardens. And this was one of them. And I criticized it for being completely inappropriate as a community garden. It was like a really she little courtyard garden with a fountain and so on. And these sponsors, in this case, this big bank, you know, are making marketing capital out of this. The reason they're sponsoring these gardens is to enhance their brand image. And I went into print saying, you know, I thought that this was, you know, a little bit expedient of them. And why aren't they? This garden is supposed to be being transplanted into a housing estate in Poplar near Canary Wharf after the event. But it's not going to be of much use to them in any way. Why only this garden? All the money they spent on this budget, this £1 million plus they'd spent on the garden, Chelsea Flower Show, to enhance their brand image, could have been spent, an equal amount could have been spent on making real community gardens for these places. I had an email from the press representative of them. It wasn't Goldman Sachs. It was Morgan Stanley. And who summoned me to the garden and said that one of the board members of Morgan Stanley wants to talk to me and put me straight about how I'd got it all wrong. So I went and had a bit of a sort of stand-up showdown with him. And he ended up kind of walking off because I just sort of said to him, well, know, it isn't really good enough. You know, you've got loads of all this money and you're just using this. And Chris Birchall was there and called me sort of cynical. Well, you know, people always call journalists cynical when they say things that they don't want to hear. I mean, I believe it's cynical, you know, to ride to bandwagon on the back of community gardening. And I know so many brilliant community gardeners across London from doing the Chelsea Fringe, most of whom do it for nothing, to kind of bandwagon on the back of that and try to use this great work in the image of your bank. So I'm not frightened either of going actually to talk to these people, and they don't really like it when you question them.
Can I stick on that point, which is just for a second, Tim, and not to be disrespectful in any way to Chris or anybody else. In conversation, for example, with Naomi Ferret-Cohen, who designed a garden at Chelsea 2018, a former guest of the show, for Cherub, a charity that encourages young people with HIV to speak and to open up about the issues, I guess, around that. I hope that's a polite way to say that. And I spoke with Naomi about, you have on one hand an option to design a garden which best shows off the garden designer, her in this case, and doesn't let herself down. And on the other hand, you have to keep the sponsor, in this case it was Cherub, happy and fulfill their brief, if you will. If I take it on Chris's example, is it a case that Chris fulfilled the brief and did what was best for the designer, but didn't do what was best for the community? Did the designer get it wrong, or did the designer follow what the money basically suggested he should do? Does that question make sense? Is that fair?
Yes, it does. And I don't blame Chris. I mean, I think Chris was being a designer, and designers have to, in a way, as you put it, follow the money. They have to do what the sponsor wants. So I suppose it's just that when Chris weighed in and called me cynical and sort of that's when I was sort of slightly taking issue with the thing, because I'm not actually being cynical. I'm calling out something which I think is, you know, a disparity. I mean, there's also a problem with these sponsors at these shows, because there's a slight feeling, of course, if you're talking about something extremely difficult, a lot of the sponsors now are charities of, you know, cancer charities or charities to do with depression or to do with, you know, children being ill. I mean, sometimes they're charities which are intimately sponsored by family members, you know, people who've been affected by these issues. So the design has to come in. And I mean, unfortunately, in most cases, these sorts of gardens are gardens which are describing some kind of metaphorical journey from illness into, if not recovery, then some sort of form of rehabilitation and a kind of a kind of reconciliation, if you like, with the world. And this is all wonderfully admirable. But the point of view, my point of view as a garden critic and trying to describe what's going on for the readership, is that the vast majority of such gardens are beset by monumental cliché. They are nearly all journeys from darkness into light. They nearly always involve some kind of rugged and jagged pathway with dark pine trees and dark shrubs, which, you know, we follow a watercourse which eventually becomes smooth and you come out into a wonderful light area with heleniums and echinaceas and grasses swaying in a sort of Elysian prairie. Now, you know, it's all right. It would be okay if I hadn't seen it 5 million times already, you know, and I just feel that I'm perfectly within my rights as a critic to actually point this out and say it is possible, you know, to make a garden that doesn't follow these cliches. Or you get gardens which are just unbelievably literal minded. The worst of these, I remember a few years ago, was I think it was a Hampton Court Palace garden where the banker client had wanted to do something about gender and women's rights in the workplace. Of course, I'm not sure what this bank is doing in reality about this, but there we are. And the way this was illustrated in the garden was literally by a glass ceiling being smashed. So there was glass all over the floor, you know, in the garden. I mean, this is literal minded to the point of being crass, in my opinion. So as you can tell, in a way, I'm exasperated about it. But the way I try to express this is really by just taking the Mickey out of it in print. And I know that readers and all the other designers love it. You know, so, although it's all for a good cause, of course, the garden.
Well, if I take an analogy, as invariably Peter does, I hear you saying at home, and I was at London Art Museum a couple of weeks ago, and in that I looked at one of the paintings and I took a photograph of it and popped it out on Twitter and noted that it was basically the modern day selfie. And it bored me to absolute tears, as most Machiavellian art does. And when I said this slightly aloud under my breath, the guy sitting next to me said, "You have no appreciation for the great." And I said, "No, it just bores me." And I personally think that is slightly aloud. And I would rather look at a book of John Lennon's badly drawn doodles. But again, that's on the front of the Imagine album. So I can't really say that either, because they're not great art in the first place. Let me sidetrack with you, Tim, however, and go back. And I don't want to misquote you, but you do note that you're not a gardener, number one. And the question that invariably is asked, which is how did you get into gardening, is something that I can't ask you because you weren't originally of that. On the other hand, you are a National Trust advisor.
Yeah, well, I'm a historian. So, I mean, my first specialism, I actually got into gardens as opposed to gardening through 18th century poetry, really. That was people like Dryden and Pope and so on. I studied English at university, and I still am a great fan of the 18th century. So, I mean, in a way, if you got deep into that subject, you couldn't really not have some kind of awareness or even interest in gardens. And also my interest in art. So, I'm now an art critic for the IDA magazine. I've always written about art as well as gardens. And I basically realized when I was about 19, going to Studley Royal in Yorkshire, actually, that garden, that it was a massive walk-through art installation. In the 1980s, when I was visiting galleries a lot, and still do, but you know, at that time, the installation art was all the rage. And I suppose I realized that these landscape gardens are like massive installations, as I say, which change all the time and are, in fact, extremely complex and nuanced and interesting, and dealing with the materials being living things and so on. And I just became fascinated with the subject. And I think I was also slightly drawn to it because, you know, in my early 20s, if I said to anyone I was interested in gardens at a party, they would just laugh at me. You know, I mean, I suspect a lot of people have had this over the years, but, you know, I quite like being up against it.
How do you balance all of this, Tim? I mean, I think you've written, correct me if I'm wrong, 14 books. You're Chelsea Fringe director, you're a National Trust advisor, you're a garden historian, you have written the course for Oxford University. You do so much. I seem to see you absolutely everywhere.
I'm sorry about that.
No, that's perfectly okay. And the Garden Museum in London, Christopher Woodward, the director there, is a former guest of the show. And that is an amazing interview. You really should go and listen to that. An amazing building, amazing history to it. I'll leave that one there and I'll park that to one side because it'll become the Christopher Woodward Memorial Show if I don't get off the subject of it. But even at that, Tim, when I was mentioning that I was going to interview you, somebody surmised it for me as this: when Tim Richardson is chosen to interview Monty, you know you're pretty much at the top of your game. And when I started to read your book, and having read all your writings, but having read them as a collection in your latest, You Should Have Been Here Last Week, I was saying, well, if I was Monty, I would be saying, Tim, please don't ask me this. And please, Tim, don't comment on this. And don't give me some of your insightful witticisms or too much critiques. I would be a little bit sitting on the edge of my seat should I have been in Monty's position.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think so. I do tread tight to fine line. I don't think I usually overstep the mark. I've only ever written to apologise actually once to somebody who I'd written about, and I felt that I had slightly gone a little bit. I'd been unfair. That's the best way of putting it. But that was in print, and certainly in person. You know, I run these regular events at the Garden Museum. I did one earlier with Tom Stuart Smith there, in sort of in conversation type events. And, you know, people don't tend to sort of run away from that or turn it down because I've got some horrible reputation of being a nasty interviewer. It's going to try to trip you up all the time. I suppose I try to have a interesting, different sort of light on what people do, maybe challenge them a bit. And I find that the best landscape people, modern people, actually relish that. They like being having their question and put in in context. As long as you're talking about their work, they're always fine, I find. Talking about them and their work, then it doesn't really matter. So I might sort of generously, which perhaps has a little bit more kind of depth to it than is apparent. But no, I haven't fallen out with anyone as a result of any of these things. And I like to think that I can sometimes get more out of people as a result of it.
Part two with Tim Richardson will air not next week, but the week after. So if you subscribe in iTunes or Spotify, it'll drop straight into your phone.